From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Now, there were three elections stolen last year. Fujimori in Peru tried to steal the election by changing the vote at the count at the last minute. Slobodan Milosevic tried to change the vote at the last minute, declared himself victor on a technicality, and so did George Bush. Three victors who lost the popular vote grabbed it on a claimed and spurious technicality. Two of those elections were overturned by people going into the streets, but not in our country.
The best democracy money can buy. A look at Enron, Argentina, and at George Bush's theft of the presidential elections of 2000 with investigative journalist Greg Palast. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court has granted Texas death row prisoner Thomas Millerell a stay of execution and said it will use his case to decide how a defendant can prove that jury selection process was unconstitutionally tainted by racial discrimination. The case will be argued next October or November. Millerell was to be executed this Thursday for the 1985 murder of a hotel clerk during a robbery at a Holiday Inn in Irving, Texas, near Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Millerell has always maintained his innocence. Despite widespread evidence of racist jury selection by Dallas County prosecutors, Millerell's conviction and death sentence were consistently upheld by state and federal courts. During his trial in 1986, prosecutors struck 10 of 11 black prospective jurors, excepting only one who said the death penalty didn't go far enough, suggesting prisoners should be tortured. A 1986 analysis by the Dallas Morning News found the state struck 90% of the African Americans eligible to serve on the juries of death penalty cases from 1980 to 1986. Of the 15 capital murder defendants during that period, five were African American, including Millerell. Four of the defendants were tried before all-white juries. A study by the Boston Globe says the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan has resulted in the deaths of 1,000 or more civilians since October. The examination looked at 14 sites bombed by U.S. warplanes in residential neighborhoods of Herat and Kandahar, as well as isolated abandoned villages. As we've consistently reported on Democracy Now!, a study by University of New Hampshire professor Mark Herod puts the number at more than 4,000 civilians killed. The Boston Globe study found that civilian deaths in some attacks exceeded Taliban and al-Qaeda deaths. The report says a large number of deaths can be attributed to the selection of targets in civilian areas. During the attacks on Tora Bora, a U.S. warplane hit the home of an associate of Osama bin Laden at the suggestion of Afghan commanders who knew he was not there. That attack killed an estimated 70 villagers. According to U.S. law enforcement officials, the Justice Department has blocked the departures of 87 foreign detainees who were ordered deported or had agreed to go home while investigators comb through information pouring in from overseas to ensure they have no ties to terrorism. Most of the detainees are Arabs or Muslims. Many have spent more than 100 days in jail waiting to leave the country with no end to detention in sight. Nearly all were jailed after being picked up on visa violations at traffic stops or because of neighbors' suspicions. Officials said available evidence suggested they played no role in September 11th attacks or the al-Qaeda network, and the immigration cases against some of them were resolved as long as 4 months ago, but they remain held in legal limbo while investigators continue to check their backgrounds. Enron Corporation quietly drew up a plan to cultivate close political ties to Vice President Al Gore during the 2000 presidential race and try to build relationships with his inner circle, even though the company was one of the biggest campaign contributors to George Bush and the Republicans. This, according to internal company documents and interviews conducted by the New York Times with officials at Enron and from the Gore campaign. The double-sided strategy was intended to ensure that Enron, the Houston-based energy company that's filed for bankruptcy protection, wielded influence with the next president, whoever he was. Enron documents show that in 1999 and 2000, the company gave more than half of so-called soft money donations to Republicans, 46% to Democrats. In 97 and 98, Enron's donations tilted much more to Republicans, 67%, with Democrats getting only 33%. But in all, Enron continued to give much more to Governor Bush than to Vice President Gore. In the aftermath of Enron's collapse, official after official is coming into question. Investigators are now looking at Enron Division Vice Chair Thomas White to determine whether his unit, Enron Energy Services, contributed to the massive misstatement of Enron's profits over the past 4 years. White, who retired in 1990 from the Army as a brigadier general, returned to the Pentagon last year as President Bush's choice as Secretary of the Army, an appointment for which his business expertise was highly touted. Now, he and others who worked at Enron Energy Services are answering investigators' questions about the unit's operations. Three Irishmen who've been detained for 6 months by the authorities in Colombia on suspicion of training rebels are being denied a fair trial. This according to their supporters and several human rights groups. Campaigners supporting Republicans James Monahan, Martin McCauley, and Neil Connolly called on the Irish government and human rights organizations to demand their freedom. The three men arrested last August in Colombia on charges of traveling on false passports and training FARC rebels. They claimed they were there to study peace talks between FARC and the Colombian government.
Wanted to start a revolution on Tuesday. She was in a pissed off mood. Her tax return didn't come in time for the rent. But they showed the We Are the World video on cable that evening, and we all held hands and cried to stop from laughing, and our anger subsided. Looking back, it could have been a plot, but there are more substantive plots to expose than the We Are the World conspiracy. Now we wait for the rain to stop. All forces on the alert. Some in Brooklyn basements, packed in between booming speakers, listening to Shabarangs and Arrested Development, boogling and doing the East Coast stomp, gargling with Bacardi and Brown Cow, breaking that monotony with slow movements, slow hip grinding movements, with the men breathing in the women's ears to earth, wind and fire's reasons, and wondering what the weather will be like next weekend.
Brooklyn Funk Essentials, Revolution Postponed, here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The taint of the Enron scandal keeps spreading, implicating an ever wider array of Washington politicos. Among the latest to fall within its shadow, Army Secretary Thomas White and former Christian Coalition Director Ralph Reed. According to the Washington Post, Reed sent a memo to Enron just weeks before the 2000 election in which he offered to help the company deregulate the electricity industry by working his, quote, good friends in Washington. At the time, Reed was serving as a campaign advisor to Bush. For a hefty six-figure fee, the conservative political strategist proposed a broad lobbying strategy that included using major campaign contributors, conservative talk shows, and yes, Washington connections. As Reed explained in his memo to Enron, quote, in public policy, it matters less who has the best arguments and more who gets heard and by whom. The memo offers a glimpse into the relationship between Enron and the ultra-conservative who was first recommended to the company in 1997 by Karl Rove, now a senior advisor to President Bush. Enlisting Reed's aid would have been in character with Enron's strategy of aligning itself with high-visibility political figures and pundits. Others who've accepted pay from Enron for their advice and other help include Bush economic advisor Lawrence Lindsay, Weekly Standard editor William Kristol, economist Paul Krugman, CNBC commentator Larry Kudlow, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick, and incoming Republican National Committee Chair Mark Rakicote. Well, we're going to turn now to investigative reporter Greg Palast, who's been examining Enron's influence peddling for years. The British tabloid The Mirror calls Greg Palast the liar. British Prime Minister Tony Blair says his reports contain not one shred of evidence. Palast's undercover investigations of corruption within the Blair government for Britain's Observer newspaper have made him New Labour's public enemy number one. He was also voted by the BBC and as the best guerrilla journalist of the year. I spoke to Greg Palast recently, just weeks after a scathing report was released, placing the blame for Enron's collapse directly on top executives like Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling. Later in the interview, he talks about Argentina and about the stolen election in Florida. This is Greg Palast, starting with Enron.
We've been looking at this for a long, long time. I mean, the American press and the American public's been taken by surprise by Enron, but Enron has been a story and, you know, a known devil in India, Argentina, England, you name it, and finally came home to roost here. And, of course, they were at the center of the deregulation scam in California. So what the new report is a wonderful whitewash, the new report coming out from the board of Enron, because it says, oh, that Ken Lay, he really should have been watching this very closely, but he wasn't watching what his minions were doing. Well, that's real bull, because what it's saying is that's his criminal defense. He's saying he was a bad boy, he should have been watching. In other words, he didn't know. And the idea that he didn't know is completely insane, because actually good work done by Rebecca Smith of the Wall Street Journal, showing that Lay was in key meetings where they came up with these schemes. And also, it'd be impossible to, the entire corporation was built on a scam.
And explain what the scam was.
Okay, there are two scams, okay, because first of all, let's go over what they did to the stockholders. They set up off-the-books corporations in which they pretended that there was a independent owner for 3% of these offshore companies named Jedi and Chewbacca, all these Star Wars characters. And, you know, they had 3,000 subsidiaries. It's hard to even find names for them. And what they did was is that they pretended that they were independent owners. But basically these other subsidiaries and hidden interests made sure that Enron had 100% control of it. By having the whole point of not having 100% control was to get the stuff off their balance sheets, they can pretend that they had assets and no losses. And in fact, there were massive losses hidden in these companies. What they had done is they sold off real assets and said the assets would be replaced by Enron stock. But of course, as the company devalued, they had to issue infinite number of shares of Enron stock until it was absolutely worth nothing. It was all watered stock scam. But the big problem, everyone's crying about the stockholders. And when we talk about stockholders who are the workers who have their entire pensions locked up in this and public pensions locked up in this, like the Florida pension system, which ended up going deep into Enron.
New York.
Yeah, all that I'm very concerned about. But what I'm not, most of the stockholders were not, your average stockholder was not crying when the stock was shooting up through the roof 80-100%. There were real other victims. In California, Enron was basically mangling, manipulating, monopolizing, cornering the power market with about six other companies that they were playing games with. And I've been looking at the specifics of this. Let me just give you an example, if I can. Enron one day sold 500 megawatts of power into California over a 15-megawatt power line. Now, what that means is that they took all, it's like taking 50 gallons of milk and trying to pour it into a 2-gallon container. If they actually sold that power, it would have vaporized the line. Of course, they couldn't, so Los Angeles was about to be blacked out, causing panic because on the other side of the line, they had to buy the power. So the price of the power in California within 1 hour shot up several thousand percent, with the result that Enron and other companies were able then to sell the power from other sources in at this massive price. In other words, they knew that they were about to jerk the market upward, and they did it a day in and day out, day after day. They themselves called it gaming, and they used tricks called stacking, cramming, false scheduling. And we don't have to go into how it was done, but it was basically a fixed casino. And out of that, we calculate, the systems operators calculate minimum $9 billion up to $20 billion of money taken out of California electricity customers' pockets due purely to manipulations, gaming, and cornering the market.
What's the criminality here?
Well, if they conspired to do that, that could possibly be criminal. One of the big problems we have is that this is, if it were really criminal, and I could say absolutely it was criminal, I'd say, you know, I'm not worried about the system because we got laws and they broke them, we'll get them, we put them in jail, there's the bad apple, goodbye. The big problem is that we deregulated the system. In other words, there's been this complete bonkers, mad deregulation mania in which we've removed all the controls. We had a law called the Public Utilities Holding Company Act, which came in under Franklin Roosevelt, That's when we also had power pirates controlling the country at the beginning of the Depression. He said, no more of this. When Bush deregulated and Clinton nodded his head and went along, but Daddy Bush, we ended up with eliminating that law and its controls. So that there used to be something called a uniform system of accounts, which is how you keep your account records. That went out the window. Pricing controls went out the window. So you had these phony markets in electricity. And we even had under the law a rule that these guys could not make political contributions. People haven't noticed that. So they deregulated the market price of electricity. They deregulated the accounting. And they deregulating political donations basically created a market in politicians where they could trade politicians. And this system was brought from Britain under Margaret Thatcher and brought to India, Argentina, other places worldwide, and that's what they've been doing. The problem is that because there's no rules there, what rules can you say they broke? So we now have to go to – I've done a lot of racketeering cases for government as an investigator, and now you have to go into conspiracy on the market, harder stuff to do. This should not have happened because it's deregulated. And now we – also Arthur Anderson – and I'm going to add in one other name. Here's a scoop for Amy Goodman. PricewaterhouseCoopers is involved here, too.
In what way?
No one was really noticing, but you have these offshore corporations, these fuzzball entities, these complete fake jobs that were set up. The supposed independent owners had to have their own auditor, not Arthur Anderson, and PricewaterhouseCoopers was used. And Sharon Watkins wrote the smoking gun letter that really nailed Lay and the rest of the gangsters.
Explain who she was.
Sharon Watkins was a mid-level executive, upper mid-level executive, who was putting on paper, hey, it looks like we're criminals, and here's why people will think we're criminals. I think she knew exactly what she was doing, and she named, and she went through some of the steps that they were doing and named people like Cliff Baxter, made sure that Lay had that letter on his desk so he couldn't say he didn't know. But she mentions also PricewaterhouseCoopers, who've been up to their knickers in this story, and because they signed off on clearly on deals that just clearly couldn't be justified.
We're talking to Greg Palast, who is an investigative reporter with BBC TV, has written books and articles on Enron, but feels like a journalist in exile. Why?
Well, look, I've been reporting on Enron grabbing nations and governments and seizing power markets for years. It was the front page news in Britain in 1998. I won the equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize for that, on seizing the government through its lobbying and with other American corporate buddies. The theft of the election in Florida was covered on the top of the BBC Nightly News. I did that report with, and the front page of The Guardian, which I also write for. Why isn't this news in the U.S. I can't get this news into the mainstream American press. I mean, I have beat my head against the wall trying to get back to America. My kids have British accents. I want to come home, you know, but I can't report the story. I'm happy to be on Democracy Now. This is like Radio Free America here, you know, but, you know, I really should be on, you know, taking these stories to the national news here.
Before we talk about the theft of the election in Florida, I wanted to go back to Enron and the kind of stories you were doing long before Enron collapsed, because it wasn't the newspapers that exposed Enron. Enron collapsed, and now the reporting is being done.
Yeah, and they're all saying, oh, my gosh, you know, like, they're all surprised. Though I'm not, it's hard to understand why journalists were surprised given the amount of money journalists were taking, including, I'm ashamed to say, Paul Krugman, who's, you know, I was reading Paul Krugman's defense of energy deregulation. I'm thinking, my God, this is against everything he's ever said in his career, in his life as an economist. And now he's flacking for this goofball Reaganite, Thatcherite, phony idea that you can have markets and water and power and things like that. And then I find out he gets $50,000 from Enron. Now, I'm not saying it bought his ideas, but
for what?
For on deregulation.
But what did he get?
Well, he got $50,000 for doing some study for him, or, you know, writing, giving some talks or doing some study. Now he disclosed it. There are other journalists who aren't disclosing their payments or had not disclosed their payments from Enron. Joe Connison was writing about that story, broke that story.
Enron,
I don't take any money from Enron.
Enron in Argentina.
Enron and Argentina. You can't actually divide the Enron collapse from the collapse of Argentina. Argentina was the poster child of globalization. Whenever you pointed to the IMF and World Bank and said, you have mangled these characters. In other words, Joe Stiglitz, when he was chief economist of the World Bank, told me he went to the leaders of the World Bank and the IMF and said, you know, every country we've touched, we've destroyed. Every time we make a suggestion what to do, and Stiglitz believed in this deregulation free market medicine that they were giving countries. He said, all the countries are collapsing. Why don't we study it? They said, we don't have to study it. We got one success story, Argentina. And here's Argentina on its back today. And part of the game was, after the military dictatorship was overthrown, was a privatization, where they sold off everything that wasn't nailed down that was owned by the government. State banks, oil pipelines, the oil company, the water company, the electric companies. It was all sold off in the name of reform and the New World Order. Well, who grabbed this stuff? The oil, one of the gas pipelines, was grabbed by a company called Enron. I'm chasing down a story right now, which was first broken by David Korn, in which the Public Works Minister said in 1988 he got a call from George W. Bush a week after his daddy was elected president saying, you know, the new Bush administration really appreciate if you would give a pipeline to a company called Enron. And this is a senator, very conservative. He knows the Bush family. He knows Neil Bush, who's heavily invested in Argentina. Enron also grabbed the water system of Buenos Aires and was just thrown out for corruption, which is hard to do. But what happened is that the country's assets basically dissipated. So when they sold off, for example, the bank stuff, all the money came out, and that's part of the story of the collapse of Argentina, because they had no assets left. They lost their oil company, which could have provided capital. They lost their basically you're paying your electric bill to U.S. corporations. So there was nothing left for the nation to own.
Greg Pallast, investigative reporter who writes for the BBC, British Guardian, British Observer. He is called the best guerrilla journalist of the year by the BBC. His latest book is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. When he comes back after the break, he'll talk, among other things, about the stolen election of 2000. Stay with us.
Something sure needs fixing, 'cause you've been mixing all my signals, and I've been saying yes when I meant no. Been second guessing from the get-go. Gotta stop stressing, just let go. Don't give me no mess unless I said so. So, 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 Mercury, have mercy, move my message through. I know it's your night off, but I'm begging you to slip into those shoes of yours and cruise.
Greg Pallast, investigative reporter for the BBC, BBC TV. In the newspaper on Monday, the New York Times, they talked about Enron, saying if the committee report proves accurate, investigators into the company's collapse will seek to pinpoint whether the same kinds of fraudulent acts that were at the foundation of the savings and loan scandals of the late 1980s and early 1990s occurred at Enron, too. These include false valuation of assets, bogus deals between related parties, millions of dollars pocketed by participants along the way. And then you talked about Neil Bush, talking about his involvement with Enron in Argentina. We go back to Neil Bush and Silverado in Colorado, the savings and loan scandal. We hear very little about this brother.
No kidding. Well, in fact, this week we've had the collapse of Global Crossing. Another gigantic, in fact, that would be the loudest crash you would have heard ever, except for Enron kind of overwhelmed it. Well, no one has mentioned, I notice in those reports, that George Herbert Walker Bush, after he left the White House, was given $13 million in stock by Global Crossing for one speech. Now, the problem is what kind of atmosphere does that create for regulators?
What is Global Crossing?
Well, it's a company that, in fact, you've never heard of this multi-billion dollar company that just went bust and blew up. But it is, they do international fiber optics, cable. And, you know, once again, we used to regulate that stuff. You couldn't just, you know, literally sink billions of dollars into the ocean and have it disappear. Before you do things like that, you had to explain your accounting, justify it, and justify the sale of the stock. That used to be a rule. Once again, we've deregulated. We've gone completely bonkers. This could not have happened under the old systems. You know, we had rules and regulations. And I got to tell you, look, it comes, if we look at Enron as one bad apple, we've really missed it. There are more Enrons coming. What I'm worried about is the ones that don't collapse, that were able, didn't go so far that they can't unwind some of it and keep the ball rolling. Because remember, it's not a victimless crime here. It's not just stockholders. It's electricity payers in California, water company customers in Argentina, power company customers in of Enron in India. I mean, there are real victims beyond the stockholders.
Well, let's go back to Argentina. You talk about Enron's involvement with the collapse of Argentina. Can you clarify it, and what does that have to do with the Bush administration?
It has plenty. First of all, if in the sense that the Bush administration, and then following up, by the way, with unfortunately the Clinton administration, who sent down Mac McLarty, who was the chief of staff of Bill Clinton, who is deeply involved in pushing for privatization in his official capacity, and then became a key money-making consultant to corporations buying up the companies that they forced these nations in Latin America to divest. So these guys go into office, force nations to privatize as a condition of getting loans from the IMF, set up consultancies, set up corporations, and go out and buy the stuff. So that's how the game works. In Argentina, in fact, I was just able, one thing I have been running reports on for the BBC and for The Guardian is I've been getting a stack of documents from inside the World Bank and inside the IMF, and I just got Jim Wolfensohn's private memo on Argentina, his plan for Argentina.
Jim Wolfensohn being president of the World Bank.
Thank you. The president of the World Bank and his little memorandum on what they had to do. First of all, it was like weirdly delusional. The country's in flames, and he's writing, it looks like things are going to improve now. We shouldn't change our strategy. But the conditions that they put in these documents, they actually call them conditionalities or triggers, to use their pleasant, assassinating term, triggers and conditionalities. They list typically in these documents 111 of them for each country, are very specific, and they'll say, you must sell the water company, or you must give British Petroleum a permit to build a pipeline. And then weird, horrible things like under something oddly called poverty reduction strategy in the Wolfensohn memo, it had a 20% reduction in payments for the emergency jobs program so that you're only getting $200 Argentine dollars a month. And he said cut that to 160. That was a condition of them getting loans from the IMF. You do two things. If you take away the money-producing assets so that money leaves the country and you cut the budgets to pay for the interest on the borrowings, which the country needed, and you keep cutting the budget. In fact, Wolfensohn said he was so proud that the country had cut $3 billion out of its primary budget to pay foreign interest payments. You can't cut budgets, sell off your assets, sell off your oil company, for God's sake. They would be rolling in dough and survive in the long term. So they had a boom for 2 years, and then that's it.
But back to Bush in Argentina.
Back
George
to Bush.
W. Bush.
George
in Argentina
W. Bush.
With Enron.
George W. Bush, according to Senator Rodolfo Tirogno, who was here, in fact, in New York at the World Economic Conference, and I'll be meeting him in London, he has said that he took a call from George W. Bush 1 week after the U.S. presidential election. George W. told him that, you know, I'm the son of the incoming president. He was surprised because he knew Neil Bush, so he knew it wasn't Neil, and so he was Neil's brother. And he said, I can't confuse Neil and George because I know Neil. And he said, and I can't forget the fact that the guy had the same exact name as the man just elected president. And Tirogno speaks English perfectly, lived in England. And he said the Bush administration would very much appreciate your giving this pipeline from Chile to Argentina to Enron Corporation.
And why would...
Now, what was really awful about that is that he said he wasn't so much offended by the pitch. He's used to that. It's Argentina. He was used to the Greece, the Greece being put in and the pressure. What offended him is that Enron was offering one-tenth of the price of its competitors. And furthermore, their offer came in after the bids were closed. They showed up with a half sheet, half a page of explanation of how they were going to buy and develop this pipeline versus the other companies. And he thought it was just outrageous that they would even ask with this price and this proposal. And what was even more outrageous, he said, is that after he left office and Carlos Menem came in, who's a golfing buddy of both George W. and George Herbert Walker Bush, and they golf all the time together, a pipeline, in fact, was given to Enron at extraordinarily favorable terms. And then they grabbed the water system Buenos Aires. Now, there was a beginning of an investigation by a prosecutor there into the story, but Menem used his power to quash the investigation of the Bushes, Enron, and Argentina.
Ultimately, Argentina threw Enron out. Is that right?
Well, not on the gas pipeline yet, but on the water. I just received note from the unions down there. It was a tragic story. Enron and its partners had promised. They have a company called Azurix. They were trying to buy all the water systems of the planet. And they had grabbed Argentina on the promise, on the capital, on the promise that they would put in money to extend the water system to all the people who didn't have water. Instead, they fired, I think, 40% of the workforce. Don't hold me to that number. But needless to say, they drew out all the cash out of the system. I'm told that at least on the gas pipeline, maybe on the water pipeline, also the asset itself went into one of these funny disappearing offshore accounts. So who knows where the asset lays at this moment. Ultimately, they were told to get lost. I mean, which is hard to do. It's quite amazing. I mean, there's an uprising now from the streets of Argentina, but to get tossed out of Latin America for corruption really takes a job.
And yet the mainstream press in this country has not reported on this until now.
I haven't seen the mainstream press report on this country even about Argentina. I pick up the New York Times, and it's all about those who, the word reform has been grabbed by the ultra-right and the globalizers. You know, reform used to mean protecting people. Now reform and liberalization means, privatizing and ending union rights, et cetera. You don't read the story. You don't read about, there was a bit finally about Taragno's accusation, the minor part of a story, with this kind of back-of-the-hand denial by Bush. In fact, one of the things that we've seen is that Bush provided, and I got a copy through David Korn of The Nation, good guy, copy of Bush's diary. Bush said he hadn't met with Taragno in Argentina because he showed that he was in Houston. On Wednesday, 2 p.m., watch the tube, open a brewski type of thing. Here I was in Houston. But Taragno never said he met with Bush. He said he got a call from Bush. So it was this typical non-answer, and that was enough for the U.S. press.
Again, we are talking to Greg Pallast, who investigates stories for BBC TV and has written the book for the United Nations, Regulation and Democracy, a technical book on how to control Enron and gang, and is also writing a book called, a book that will be published in the next month, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. You talk about the election of 2000. You talk about Florida being stolen. Can you lay out the story that you actually did for the Washington Post? The problem is you had the story before the election, and they published it months later.
Well, we had the story before Gore could see it. What happened was, let me tell you what the story was, which is that in the year leading up to the election, Catherine Harris and her elections commission, and her elections division.
The Florida Secretary of State.
She was Florida Secretary of State. Purged from the voter rolls 57,700 voters. As it turns out, 54% of those on the purge list were black when the population is only 13% black.
And this happened months before.
Now, the grounds for purging these people were that they were felons who aren't entitled to vote in Florida. So that would be legitimate no matter the color of the voters. The problem was the voters weren't felons. They were only guilty of being black. Only at, you know, charitably, 5% of the names on that list, 5% were of real felons, criminals who couldn't vote. Some Florida papers began to smell a rat on this, but took a complete snow job from Catherine Harris's office and Jeb Bush's office. I broke this story on the front page of the British newspapers. I broke the story on the top of the nightly news. By the way, my program is called Newsnight. I know they'll want me to get that in there. You can actually think watch it on BBC America here. But that, you know, if you got that cable, then if you want to know what happened in Florida, you have to go to London, which is a little berserk. So we got that on the top of the news. It was big news all over Europe, so that everyone in Europe knew this guy was never elected. Now, that story first broke within 3 weeks of the election. Al Gore had not conceded. Every one of these reporters, you know, gazillions of reporters running around looking at Chads and having cute little conversations with Catherine Harris, but no one's checking into these facts. And I have to tell you one sad story. I broke the story in Britain. There was some coverage here through the internet magazine Salon.com, and it was picked up by some columnists here who were trying to push the story, and the U.S. Civil Rights Commission asked for the material. But CBS News then, Nightly News, called me up from Florida and said, quick, could you give us some of the story? Give us some of the story. Give us something new. And I'm saying, well, look, I'm an American. I care about, you know, what happens to our democracy. So even though you're a competitor, I'll give you part of the story. And part of the story was that there were 2,800 names on the list of real felons, but these were people who actually had the right to vote. They had the right to vote under Florida law because they came from places like New York where you don't lose your right to vote because you've been to jail. And they had the right to vote. And I just had a double check on the facts and get some information. So I said, this story's ready to go. You can have it. They didn't run it that night. They didn't run it the next night. And I said, what happened? They said, well, we checked it out and your story doesn't stand up. And I said, oh, really? How did you check it out? I said, well, we called Jeb Bush's office and he said that they didn't do it. I said, oh, you called Jeb Bush's office. You know, I didn't think of doing that. You know, I get, oh, okay. Oh, then maybe I should just give up on the story. Later, the story did run again at the top of the news in Britain, and we found a home in Nation magazine. Was the only place that would pick it up until the Washington Post finally showed up with the story with my commentary and explanation in June. That's 7 months after the election.
And how did they headline the story?
And it was like buried way back, and it was all about, I can't remember the exact headline, but it was very downplayed. They did say, oh, gee, look, this should not have been done. It was just a screw-up. That was the other thing, is that it was just, gee, a mistake which changed the election and was based, an election-based decision based on race. Remember what's at the bottom of this. The other problem with the Post story is that, well, first it was 7 months late, but I'm not going to knock them at least for running it, but they also ran it when they had the U.S. Civil Rights Commission telling them the story was correct. In other words, as long as you had official denial from Jeb Bush, no one would touch the story. No one would touch it. If he had denial. Now, once they had the official imprimatur of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission saying this is what happened, then they were willing to run out from the hills and shoot the wounded.
Why didn't Gore go for this? The information was coming out before he conceded. Jesse Jackson going down, he was willing to hold protests. He was told to get out of town by Gore and his people. Why?
Well, I can't creep into the mind of Al Gore. Now, I'm not even sure that's a pleasant thing to do, but I would have to say that, he chose to stand with the elite. Now, there were three elections stolen last year. Fujimori in Peru tried to steal the election by changing the vote at the count at the last minute. Slobodan Milosevic tried to change the vote at the last minute, declared himself victor on a technicality, and so did George Bush. Three victors who lost the popular vote, grabbed it on acclaimed and spurious technicality. two of those elections were overturned by people going into the streets, but not in our country. And, you know, when people say, let's move on, I always wonder what you mean by moving on from democracy. Exactly where is it we're going? But that also, by the way, undercuts Bush's legitimacy in Europe, because my stories and the follow-up from it were big news. So everyone knows this guy wasn't elected. And so you have an unelected president who represents the United States when he goes to Europe. It's, believe me, that's a real problem for our nation.
And how did Jeb Bush fix this, according to your research in
Florida? Jeb Bush, in fact, I'm going to give you a plug for Harper's Magazine, which is going to have a story and an explanation on this in the upcoming issue of Harper's. And bless him for it. They're actually going to, you can see a chunk of the computer list that scrubbed out all these black voters. But where Jeb Bush's office personally, where he stepped in, not just Catherine Harris, he can't lay it all off on Harris, though there's plenty to lay off on her. Jeb Bush issued the letter saying, knock out people who have the right to vote from other states. They may have committed a crime. We know that they have the right to vote, but don't let them register. Take them off the list. Now, that was a letter written on September 18th, a few weeks before the election. I asked for a copy of the letter from his office twice, and I was told, we don't have a letter September 18th on the subject. We have one on February from this on the subject. And the February letter was very much in accordance with the laws of the United States, which said these people may vote. People with the right to vote, we should help them register, and here's how we do it. So one letter says they can't vote before the election, so they don't get to vote, and then it's replaced by one that says they can vote, and golly gee, they say that the first letter not only isn't in their files, but they can't find it on their computer hard drives. Now, as it turns out, I have a copy of both letters, and I think if you get my book, Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which you can actually order now, you can see the two letters, actually see the illustrations of the two letters side by side.
Anything else you want to add about this investigation that, we see what this election has wrought? Well, a man who is not declared president who is not popularly elected president has declared war on the world.
Well, I'm sickened by the way it was handled or not handled by the U.S. This is an important story, and it was exactly how the election was stolen. And, in fact, when the U.S. Civil Rights Commission came out and brought out this material, used this material, the only story that came out about the U.S. Elections Commission was the right wing saying, well, look at those people. You know how they were going to decide. In other words, because it had black people. You had a black woman as a chairwoman of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission and black counsel and black members. And that was the whole issue. All those black people said we stole the election, and they released the report too early or something. And no one covered what they did. So it just wasn't covered in the USA. And what was even worse is you had these counter stories. I know that ABC Nightline, and I just don't know what was up with them. They're a sister program to my program in London. They went down to Florida, and they interviewed a bunch of people and experts who said, well, you know, these ballots are very complicated. Black voters and new voters, they have a tough time filling out the ballots. And what they were saying is that black people are too friggin' dumb to figure out how to vote. I went into to speak with the county supervisors, and they showed me the paper ballot machine. In the white counties where they had paper ballots, if you put a ballot with a miss mark on the machine, it came back to you, and they would tell you what you did wrong or say you have an extra mark, and you get to vote again. In Gadsden County, for example, which is the blackest county in Florida, if you made any mistake on your ballot, the machine took your ballot, discarded it, voided it, and you didn't know it. And that was simply, you know, basically flipping a switch on the machine. Now, in Gadsden, 1 in 8 votes, the blackest county in Florida, 1 in 8 votes was not counted. In right next door in Leon County, a white county, only 1 in 200 votes was spoiled. And it wasn't because that black people can't figure out the ballot. It was that they happened to be in a black county with the bad machines. So the entire process, both, it was not only a fixed process, but unfortunately the coverage was fixed too. And that's disturbing to me.
Meaning?
Well, it's disturbing to me personally because I can't report these stories in the United States of America, and I'd like to come home, you know. So it's kind of a personal matter.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Greg Pallast. He is an investigative reporter having a little trouble getting his reports in the United States, but one of his pieces will appear in Harper's Magazine. His books, Regulation and Democracy, a technical book on how to control Enron, and the latest book from Pluto Press, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Thank you.
Thanks, Amy.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
To handle stars in the night, blazing their light, can't hold a candle to your razzle dazzle. You got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride, full of butterflies inside. Wanna cry, wanna croon, wanna laugh like a loon. That old devil moon in your eyes. Just when I think I'm...
Old Devil Moon, sung by Yip Harburg, here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, today is President's Day, the national holiday honoring all presidents of the United States, good presidents, bad presidents, long-dead presidents, recent presidents. It even honors impeached presidents. But what about illegitimate presidents? Does a person who was selected rather than elected get to bask in the glow of the holiday? Well, today, in recognition of President's Day, we continue our discussion of the stolen election of 2000. Several months ago, in mid-November, a review of uncounted ballots in the Bush-Gore election revealed that George W. Bush would have lost Florida and therefore the presidency if there had been a complete statewide recount. The data compiled by Associated Press and seven other new organizations shows that, yes, Gore would have won Florida if all the votes had been recounted. Ironically, Bush would have won only if Gore had gotten what he wanted, which was a recount of just four counties. But this is not how the major media reported it several months ago. Virtually every newspaper in the country said the opposite, that the recount study showed Bush carried Florida. The results of the study indicating that the wrong person is in the White House would be incredible under any circumstances, but even more so considering the fact the man in power has declared war on the world. We now go to an interview I conducted in mid-November with author Jeffrey Toobin. As a staff writer for The New Yorker, Toobin spent much of the fall of 2000 in Florida reporting on the battle for the presidency. At the time of the interview, he just published his own book about the infamous election. I began by asking him about the book and why, despite his argument that Gore had won the election, it was titled Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election. This is Jeffrey Toobin.
Well, I mean, I think you have to acknowledge it was an awfully close election, and it was very, very close. But if you look at sort of the general idea of the intent of the voters, who did most people intend to vote for in Florida? There, I don't think there's even the slightest doubt that Al Gore won, because you had things like 3,400 votes in Palm Beach County for Pat Buchanan, when he didn't even receive 1,000 votes in anywhere else. Many of those votes, or several thousand, were obviously intended for Gore. 7,000 votes in Duval County, which is Jacksonville, predominantly black areas that were not counted because of a confusing ballot there. Now, some of those, there was no way to really recapture in a recount. It was just sort of too bad they were miscast. But even as this study suggests, if you recounted all the votes under a legal process, Gore would have won. So I do think Gore would have won the election.
Talk about how Gore lost it strategically.
Well, I think, again, this recount really underlines the flaws in the Gore strategy. Gore was, I think, very much a prisoner of the Washington conventional wisdom, which said that this matter had to be decided quickly, had to be resolved without recourse to the courts, and in a purely judicious manner, not involving any sort of political protest or activity. And What Gore decided was, in the initial days after the election, is that he was only going to ask for recounts in four counties, because he thought that would be perceived as a modest step, a limited step towards a recount without throwing the whole state into tumult. I think that was, among other things, evidence of Gore's political tin ear, because instead of being praised for just acting in four counties, he was lambasted, I think largely correctly, because those were only heavily Democratic counties that went for him, instead of asking for a full statewide recount, which, as this study shows, might well have put him in the lead. In fairness to Gore, it needs to be pointed out that there was no mechanism in Florida to simply ask for a statewide recount. He would have had to go county by county requesting it. But I think he would have been in a better position politically, legally, morally, if he had asked for a statewide recount. But he didn't want to ruffle feathers, and he was wrong.
There was also a conversation going on that he didn't want to win it because of black counties in Florida. He didn't want African Americans to take him over the top.
Well, he actually wound up asking for four counties with heavily black populations, so I don't know if I buy that theory. I think he just, he was afraid. I mean, you know, one of the first things he did after, you know, the Florida controversy started was to call up Jesse Jackson and say, you know, knock it off with the protests. We don't want that kind of activity. This was at the same time that the Republicans were mobilizing congressional aides to come down to Miami and protest. And at the same time, you know, the Elian Gonzalez coalition was being reassembled in Miami, Dade County, to organize protests against the Clinton-Gore administration. So, I mean, you had a very different philosophy in the two sides.
In fact, right after Elian Gonzalez was sent back to Cuba, they immediately started to move in on Gore, that whole community.
Well, and again, it was evidence of Gore's limited political skills. Because if you recall, Gore took all kinds of abuse during last year's campaign because he had a slightly different position than the Clinton administration. He thought Elian's fate should be determined by a family court, which was much closer to the Miami Cuban's position. But so he was simultaneously lambasted as a sellout to the Miami Cubans, and the Miami Cubans hated him because he was Bill Clinton's vice president. So he had the worst of all possible worlds in that story.
Talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and when this actually did go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, this is sort of a behind-the-scenes story from the Supreme Court, which is also an illustration of the larger theme of too close to call. As everyone now remembers, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that George Bush's equal protection rights had been violated by the Florida Supreme Court. In her initial draft of her dissenting opinion, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, well, as far as I can tell from Florida, the only people whose equal protection rights were violated were black voters. Justice Scalia, who was sort of the leading voice for the majority, wrote her a memo that said, you know, you're using Al Sharpton tactics. You're playing the race card, and you shouldn't do it. And what did Ruth Bader Ginsburg do? Well, she withdrew that portion of her opinion that related to race. She didn't want to be perceived as inflammatory. Again, you have this difference between the Republicans, who were, you know, full bore, all out in their attempts to win this election, and Ginsburg, like Gore, like the Democrats generally, reluctant to push things to a head.
This whole issue of wanting protests to stop, for not having people in the street, when at least the perception is the way elections work is you vote and each vote gets counted. The question is getting people to the polls. Why did Gore think that that was not to his advantage?
Well, because the view in, you know, the editorial pages that Gore cared about was that this process could not be perceived as too political, could not. You know, be seen as indicative of mob rule. Gore felt that, you know, he did not want to lose that constituency, so he shut down any kind of protests on his behalf. I mean, one of the striking things as a reporter who was covering the story in Tallahassee, as I did throughout this recount, was that you never saw pro-Gore protesters. You saw Bush protesters all the time. And that kind of thing has an impact on you as a reporter. You get the impression that one side cares and one side doesn't. And, you know, you remember, and this was a conscious strategy, that there were hundreds of protesters outside Gore's home, the vice president's mansion in Washington. That really created the impression that the Bush people cared a lot more than the Gore people did. And I think, in a way, it was true. They did care more.
We're talking to Jeffrey Toobin, who is the author of a book on the election, Too Close to Call, the 36-day battle to decide the 2000 election. A lot of people feel like a coup took place in this country.
I think that's overstated. I do think that this election was decided according to legal processes. I think they were very flawed processes. I think the Florida system for counting its votes was outrageously bad. I think Catherine Harris, who was in charge of that system, was a combination of incompetent and malevolent. I mean, one of the shocking things I learned in Too Close to Call, I think, is that, you know, the so-called automatic recount, the recount that took place in the 2 days after the election when all the ballots in the state were supposed to be run through the machines again, actually never took place. A quarter of the votes to this day, 1.25 million votes, have never been recounted because Catherine Harris didn't want them recounted, didn't want to take the chance.
So why do you call that incompetent? Sounds like she was extremely competent.
Well, I said it was also malevolence. I mean, the fact is Harris knew almost nothing about Florida election law and was basically steered in the appropriate direction by a Bush campaign advisor who was basically put at her side and assigned to tell her what to do throughout this process. So she didn't really know what she was doing. His name was Max Stepanovich, and it's really an extraordinary part of this tale that, you know, Max Stepanovich, a sort of well-known Republican power broker in Tallahassee, went to the Bush campaign the day after the election and said, well, what do you want me to do? Put me to work. And they said, go babysit Catherine Harris. And that's exactly what he did for the entire time until she certified the election, was sat by her side and told her how to interpret the law in Bush's favor.
Tell us who Catherine Harris was. What was her background? Where is she going now?
And I mean, it's very clear where she's going now is the U.S. Congress. She's about to take a safe Republican seat near her home in Sarasota. I think it's Sarasota. And she was a state senator briefly. She had no particular political background. She ran a vicious negative campaign against the incumbent Republican Secretary of State to win in 1998. The job is being abolished in 2002, so she needed a new job. The question was she going to get an appointed job from a new Bush administration? And she tried to make sure of that because she was co-chair of the Bush campaign, the George W. Bush for President campaign in Florida. And but she got a better offer. She's going to be a congresswoman from Central Florida now.
Didn't Al Gore want her deposed, investigated?
No, the problem was his lawyers wanted her deposed. I mean, one of the things that occurred to me as a lawyer was, you know, we had all these court hearings, but you never had any witnesses. Why didn't you call any witnesses? And some of Gore's lawyers said they wanted to call Catherine Harris to the stand and expose, you know, put her under oath, cross-examine her about her biases, about the fact that she was co-chairman of the Gore campaign, of the Bush campaign. And Gore and the people around him, Warren Christopher, Bill Daley, said, no, we don't want to do that. She's a statewide elected official. That would be perceived as too confrontational. Again, the theme of Too Close to Call, that the Gore campaign was consumed with this idea of being decorous while, you know, the Bush campaign was breaking bar stools over their head.
So you have James Baker, who was brought in to be the, what, elder statesman, frontman for George W. Bush, as Warren Christopher was for Al Gore. James Baker probably profiting very handsomely right now from George W. Bush being president. He, with George Bush Sr., with the Carlyle Group, their major investors and weapons manufacturers, and with oil all over the world. What was James Baker's role?
Well, I to be honest, I don't really think it was about money. I think it was about James Baker getting back into the fray. I mean, this is a guy.
Jeff Toobin writes for The New Yorker magazine and is author of Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election. And that does it for today's program. Our website is www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Jeremy Scahill, and Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Again, our email address, mail@democracynow.org. And we are broadcasting from downtown Community Television, a firehouse just blocks from where
Ground Zero is where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Something sure needs fixing, cause you've been mixing all my signals, and I've been saying yes when I meant no, been second guessing from the get-go. Gotta stop stressing, just let go, don't give me no mess unless I said so. So, Mercury.